thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this podcast from Celtic Underground. You are possibly picking this up on thecelticunderground.substack.com. If you are a paid subscriber, you can link your account to wherever you pick up your podcasts, whether that be Spotify, Apple, Amazon, wherever, and you can pick up the subscription feed where you get your normal feed. Just go on to Substack on the website and follow the instructions. Meantime, this is Andrew H. Smith in conversation.
Hi, welcome to Celtic Underground, and it's a real privilege, the guest I have tonight, Tommy. I was going to say Tommy Burns, but we almost don't need to say, we don't need the second name. Tommy's one of the most, our most revered special figures in the modern age, he's Celtic, and there's nobody better placed and talk through his life and his legacy and his daughter, Jenna. Jenna, lovely to have you on. Thanks very much for coming on.
No, thank you very much for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
And I know, like, sorry, I don't want to, like, but I don't want to be crass and acknowledge this. It can't have been easy for you the last 7 months.
No, definitely not.
Your mum.
Yeah, Rosemary. Just obviously at the time, a real shock. And I mean, you feel as if time just crawls by. Do you know what I mean? It could have been 7 days ago for all that. You feel you've kind of moved on at times, do you know what I mean? But I don't know, it's grief's like a total roller coaster that comes in waves, and a horrible time, to say, really kind of unexpected and stuff like that. So it's been difficult.
Yeah, because I mean, I've long since lost both my parents, and I was just thinking about it uncannily, like roughly the same age as you lost each of your parents.
Oh, really?
By a matter of months difference.
Mm-hmm.
15 mm-hmm. years apart. My mum first, and then my dad died just a couple of months before your dad, Tommy.
So it's funny because I think it feels like when we lost my mum, it's almost like you're losing.
Nope, that's what I was going to
ask. My dad over again as well. Do you know what I mean? Because there's so much. It's just so much more finality to it because, I don't know, now they're both, it's just
No.
It's just unfathomable, do you know what I mean? Like, to get your head round, you're like that.
You're not going to believe this, I'd written that down. It's like, when we lost my dad, I thought we lost part of my mum again.
Yeah, totally.
And it was like, I can't ask him about my mum, and I felt like I'd lost that kind of link.
100%, totally. There's all the things that you think. Just, and it's weird because you feel as if like it's on your mind all the time.
Mm.
But then you have these kind of unconscious moments where you think, oh, I need to ask my mum will know that. Or,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, you're like, how did my brain allow me to forget there for like, you know, a split second that thought would come into my head that I'd be able to do that? Do you know what I mean? You lose a big part of them as well because it's all your... Just the person that knows everything. Don't get me wrong, we would argue black was white at times against each other. But definitely that person that you just knows everything about your whole life up until now. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, aye, tough, very tough.
I worked with a lassie who was a brilliant writer. She once wrote this line that I've never ever forgotten. She said, "Bereavement isn't something you go through. Bereavement's tattooed in your heart."
Totally.
And sometimes, you know, it's like you want to, time doesn't heal. Time doesn't heal. You know, there's not a day passed since my mum died 33 years ago. I don't think about her and wish she was around, but time gives you that kind of perspective, or the distance. The distance gives you a wee bit, I can remember, you know what I mean? You remember more of the good things as opposed to remembering our last day or whatever, and getting that phone call and all that stuff, you know?
Definitely. I say that all the time, probably more so, like, mum is obviously a complete shock, like, total shock. And unfortunately, we weren't with her. Like, I had travelled to Cork, knowing that she was there and never made it in time. But, like, with my dad, we were there at the time. And I almost think, let's see now, like, it would take me a lot to, and ever since then, like, it would take me a lot to actually tap into my memories of that specific time. And I've said this before a million times, like, I feel as if, like, your mind is obviously so powerful, because it's definitely, it's like self-preservation, because I feel like, see, if you actually could sort of vividly remember that every single day, it would knock you off your head. Do you know what I mean? Like, you would, it would be so, so difficult to kind of continuously live that. So sometimes I feel as if, like, your mind almost kind of protects you from those moments by them not being at the forefront of your mind. Do you know what I mean?
No, I do. And it was funny, I was talking to my brother the other day about my mum's last day. Again, like you, it was a complete shock. I got the phone call to hear my dad crying in the background. I'd never really heard him crying much in his other life. And my auntie was saying, you need to come home, your mum's not well. And I knew, you just know, you know, somehow you just knew. But I was talking to her, John, about it the other day, and he couldn't remember all these things. Maybe, unfortunately, I remember too much, you know. Like, I've got an imprint, and they said that, I can't remember any of that stuff you're saying.
Yeah, that's funny. My sister's a wee bit like that as well. She's like, just so many, like, kind of gaps in her memory from round about that time. Obviously, she just had a wee baby, like, my dad died as well, do you know what I mean? And then I think, like, everything my mum, like, we're still very much in the thick of that, do you know what I mean? Like, so I dare say we'll probably look back in years to come at just now and be much the same, do you know what I mean? Like, God, I don't remember that happening, or I remember that a different way, or whatever it might be. So, but yeah, I've definitely got that about my dad, and I don't think it's anything to do with the time that it's passed. I think it's actually, as I say, kind of self-preservation more so.
Yeah, I would have wanted, you know, I wish I could forget some of the things, because wasn't he good? My dad, like you, my mum died suddenly, my dad, we were with him in the hospital, and I was never very sure which one was better, you know, in the sense of...
I know. I remember when my dad passed away, a woman that I work with, saying that I think her dad, like, fell down the stairs or something like that, so it was sudden, it was shocking, he was a young man, and I remember her saying to me at the time, oh, but I don't think I could have done what you've done, I don't think I could have watched that happen, but then there's a part of you that thinks, God, as you say, I don't even know which one is worse, knowing that it's going to happen, they're actually having it completely snatched away from you and having all the, God, I should have said this, I should have done that, or did she know this, did she know that, do you know what I mean? So, I mean, I don't think there's any preferred way, to be perfectly honest, but obviously you just don't want anybody to suffer or probably know or be frightened about what's ahead of them, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I was surprised because my dad's faith was so strong, my mum and dad, daily communicants and all that, you know, but I was surprised, I could see the fear in the last couple of hours, you know, I could see the fear, and that wasn't pleasant either, you know?
No, definitely.
Sorry, I don't mean to really, really bring you down here, by the way.
I love I like a morbid life chat, Andrew, so it's fine, you're in good company.
Oh, you've come to the right person.
Yeah, I like it. No, I know what you mean, and it's funny, because I think, like, when it was my dad, see, for that reason, I'm glad that my mum never knew it was a headover, because I don't think she would have been able, I do not think she'd have been able to deal with that way. My dad was slightly different, like, he was definitely frightened initially when he got that kind of, you know, diagnosis to say it was kind of terminal and, you know, you're putting a time limit then on your life sort of thing. So, and he was definitely frightened at that point. But I think as time went on, obviously like that, his kind of faith was so strong and stuff like that as well. And I remember at that point he was home and in the house. And like that, the kind of local priest was coming in every day to kind of give him communion, hear his confession, speak to him, all that sort of thing. And it was Monsignor Monaghan, his name was, and I remember he was coming down the hall one day after being in the room with my dad, and he said to my mum, he's like, you know, he said, when it's my turn to go, he said, if I'm half as prepared and half as accepting as Tommy is, then I'll die a kind of content, happy man sort of thing. So he definitely kind of, and that kind of final couple of weeks, I would say, was probably at peace with it, I would say.
Yeah, God. Look, and only 51 as well. It's hard to believe.
And see, the closer you get, the older you get, the closer you get to that age, and you've got
57 now. So.
You know, you're like that. God, that was so young, and I don't even think I realised so much at the time. But as I say, the more time goes on and you see people that age, think, God, that's... my dad was younger than that when he passed away, or my dad was their age, or and that is tough to take. That's a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah, definitely. Because I don't know, maybe his bearing, I always felt your dad kind of was maybe kind of older than he was. You know, I'm thinking even his time at Kelly, because I started just as your dad. I mean, I had posters of your dad because I used to always have the file-ons. My mum was obsessed with your dad. You know, the book used to sit beside. I've talked about it before in the podcast about how in our bookshelf, you know, behind that chair, you know, the one that you could ease back in and it goes up in the front. Well, that was my dad's chair, but behind that it was the Bible. It was the Peer's Encyclopedia. It was the Biographical Dictionary, because I used to love reading all about people's lives, you know, the wee Wikipedia entries as it was then. And then beside that, it was the Glory and the Dream, which was the phenomenon. That's a kind of seminal Celtic history book. And then beside that, it was Twists and Turns, the Tommy Byrne story, you know. And that, you know, I can just picture that. That's how my living room was. Because my mum, obviously, because they were so strong in their faith, the fact my mum was obsessed with Celtic.
Yeah. But
with your dad, that's like hitting the jackpot, you know, like, you know.
Yeah, totally.
You get Celtic and Catholicism, you know what I mean? And they like melded.
I know.
In this kind of, you know, incredible package.
Definitely.
So, you know, it was like, she was like, you know, she was totally obsessed by him. But when I got the job at Celtic, one of the things I thought, I'm gonna get to know him and all that, you know. Mm-hmm. Your dad left the week after. Mm-hmm. And you must have been about 4 and a half, so do you really have any memories of playing for Celtic?
So, do you know, I feel like my earliest memory is my dad's testimonial, right? And I don't know if because I watched videos back, if I actually think that's my memory. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Aye, definitely.
And I don't know for sure, but I remember that, and I don't actually remember him playing anything like that. What I do remember is at the, I don't know if it was like a meal or whatever it was after it, he was giving all the players a gift. And I think now they get like Rolex watches and all that. At that point, it was like a Sony Walkman. It was wrapped in like gold wrapping paper.
Yeah.
And I remember like my dad with these gold boxes, like handing them out. So I'd say that's probably my earliest memory of him playing, or like that time anyway.
Yeah.
But I've got really kind of vivid memories of Kilmarnock. And then when he was back at Celtic as a manager and stuff like that as well, because I was like, I'd go everywhere with him. So if Celtic were playing at home or Kelly were playing at home, I would go in with my dad. So we'd be like first in, last out. I was just with him all the time. I would just get tapped into a room to sit with all sorts of random characters over the years. Do you know what I mean?
This is you. You're talking 5, 6, 7, like for Kilmarnock, 7, 8, 9, you know, and then... Aye, sorry, so you would be about 8 when he come back as manager. Do you remember that kind of, I mean, it's hard to know what your parents are just kind of there and they do what they do, but do you remember them kind of how it was? And because it was such a kind of...
So I remember him getting the job because we were on holiday in Tenerife at the time, and we'd always stayed in the same apartments or same kind of area in Las Americas. That's where we went every single year. And I don't know why, but for some reason this year we'd booked to stay a bit further out in a villa. And when we went there, we're all like, no, hate it, like, don't like this at all. So we went back to stay in the apartments that we used to stay in Las Americas. Went there and it was like 4 a.m, pure boom, 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 like obviously next to like a dancing.
Oh, right.
My dad was like, nope, bags packed again, back into the taxi and back to the villa. And under the placemat at the front of the door, because at that point in time, nobody really had mobile phones, or they certainly weren't as common.
No, they weren't really, no, in 94.
When we went back to the villa, there was a note under the door, basically saying to my dad that there'd been a message left for him and he was to phone home. I think he was to phone, and I don't know if it was Billy Stark he was to phone, I think it might have been. And basically that was the kind of ball roll, and then for him to get, like, the Celtic job. So he left. He went away and then left us.
All right.
That was it. So he then became the Celtic manager. And at that point, the first season was in Hampden.
Hampden,
So I remember that. It was, like, kind of drab inside. It was all kind of dark and all that. Like, it was... but it seemed to be
permanently winter that season. That's all I think about it. It was just permanently winter.
Yeah, totally. It wasn't great at all, but and I can't remember like too much about it, but I can remember more so like being in the players' lounge, and I remember like when Phil O'Donnell signed and his wife Eileen, and do you know what I mean? Like, I had it like Pierre when he came, so I remember all those types of things that kind of happened at that time. So, and it was a good, like, it was a great little few years.
You know? And you said you were a bit of a tomboy, so did you like football yourself anyway, just kind of naturally? Or?
Yeah, aye. Never played it like that, but I've always watched it, like, went to all the games, like my dad, if he was going to like reserve games during the week or whatever, I would go sometimes. Emma, my sister, so she's 3 years older than me, so she would sometimes be there as well. So yeah, we've always, like, even now, like, I mean, Emma and I could be sitting in the living room just blathering and there's football on the television. It's just a thing. Constant. It's almost like a comfort, to be perfectly honest, do you know what I mean? So yeah,
They were really pressurised times. I remember your dad used to, he didn't like to see if you were waiting for the bus, you know, like across the London Road, you know, just out the park.
Mm-hmm.
He'd give you a lift because he'd, or sometimes if you were walking towards, looked like you were walking towards Bridgeton, he would stop, pick up. Mm-hmm. Like, I was a Celtic View editor at that time and all that. And we were driving one time just before they played Raith Rovers, and I says to him, "Tommy, you know you need to win this." He said, I know, son. You know, like, yeah, like, and obviously they didn't and all that, but you were probably still really young to remember the kind of whole kind of fallout of all that.
I remember actually being at the game, because it was penalties, wasn't it?
It was penalties.
I remember being at the game and actually being down in the toilets, the ladies' toilets, when the penalty shootout was being taken, with like my mum and other like wives of players and stuff like that.
So
everybody's nerves were shattered, do you know what I mean? And probably the last person on earth you would ever want to miss it was Paul McStay, do you know what I mean? Just so cruel. But I do actually remember that. So
God, that's you only kind of, you're almost 10 then, I suppose. You were almost 10 then, eh?
Mm-hmm.
And like, as I say, the pressure that was on then, I saw it kind of affecting your dad. You must have seen that inside your own house, you know.
I think.
Did the fathers, did they hide that for their
children? Yeah, I do feel like, I mean, we were very much like, his job certainly never stopped at the door before he came in, do you know what I mean? Like, absolutely not, because there was football on the television constantly, bits of paper everywhere with wee crosses and circles for, you know, 4-4-2 this and whatever, arrows and all sorts. So that was all over the house. So he was kind of always working, do you know what I mean? Always on the phone, like, and at that point, again, it was house phones. There would be, like, agents and, like journalists and stuff like that you'd think nothing of, just phoning your house phone, do you know what I mean?
Steady.
Yeah, you know what I mean? They're a good relationship as well, do you know what I mean? But there's kind of no getting away from it at that point. It's not like you can sort of block somebody's number or just kind of not answer it if you see who it is, do you know what I mean? So a totally different time back then, to be fair. But I wouldn't say I necessarily, certainly not at that age anyway, would have felt like the kind of pressure that he was under, do you know what I mean? I think we were probably quite shielded from that, because he was always like a pure character in the house, do you know what I mean? Like, he was like life and soul and joking and carrying on and stuff like that. So you very rarely would have been seen him and thought, oh God, he's under pressure. I don't even know what that is. I would have tuned into that, to be honest, do you know what I mean?
And is that what he was like? Is very kind of hands-on as a dad, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, but not hands-on in terms of anything domestic whatsoever. Like, no, absolutely not.
That kind of man.
like, really, like the extreme opposite, I would say. But yeah, just somebody who was, like, an absolute joy to be around. Do you know what I mean? And it took a lot to break his temper. You certainly wouldn't want to do that, that's for sure. But you very rarely seen that side to him. So he was the type of person that you just wanted to be in his company just because, do you know what I mean? Like, you just gravitated towards him, like, so he was like that in the house as well, even with us, do you know what I mean? You were, like, delighted to see him coming into his work, and if he's sitting outside in the car on the phone, you'd be pure looking to see, like, when's he coming in, do you know what I mean? So, yeah, he was, just great person to be around.
because I saw a different, because I was thought, this is brilliant, this is my chance now to get to know your dad. And in some ways, but then I was the editor, so the editor doesn't do all the player the interviews necessarily, you're putting the thing together and all that. So I was a wee bit detached, and the way it worked at Celtic View, I suppose if you were the editor, you dealt more with wee Fergus than the kind of board and all that. And I always wondered if Tommy felt always kind of on their side. Yeah. You know, like I never quite get perfectly fine and all that, like, but he was much closer to my two colleagues, you know.
Yeah.
They spoke to him more. I used to do the programme notes, the manager's Billy McNeil and all that kind of stuff, and I wasn't doing it by then, so I never ever developed, I'm just being honest, I never developed the kind of rapport I thought I would. And I just saw him stressed out his box a lot. It felt like me. I almost saw him aging in those 3 years.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I remember saying that to Alex McLeish at Rangers, and he wasn't too happy. You know, that was just before he got the boot for Rangers and all that. I said, saw a picture of you just when you signed to the Rangers, and you look a totally different guy. But
that's definitely the reality of it. Like, there's no two ways about it. I mean, even when I look at pictures of my dad, like, my screensaver on my phone is actually my mum and dad. A picture of the two of them, the Celtic View, done pictures of us as a family when we went back to Celtic, like, as a manager. So, and his hair's pure red. And then by the end, I remember someone saying, was your dad's hair blonde? And I was like, no, that's white. Like, that's age, do you know what I mean? It's just hair going from ginger to white in the space of like a couple of years. And he's still young, do you know what I mean?
Young. That's when you forget how young he was.
I know.
And probably too young, but you can't turn it down, you know what I mean? No. You need to take the opportunity.
Totally. Because you'd just be saying, what if for the rest of your life, do you know what I mean? And nobody wants to live a life like that, do you know what I mean?
I know. But that, the 95 Cup final, you know, like, again, well, you're 10 by now, so you'll have a decent memory of that.
Yeah, remember being at that game. I remember sitting really kind of high up, but managing to get myself down onto the pitch anyway by the end of the the end of the game. And just brilliant day, like, just so much joy and relief. And
it was
you're like happy for yourself as a fan that goes to the games every week. Like, it's amazing. It's so happy. It's so good to see all these people so happy. So pleased for my dad, so happy for, like, the players, because at that point it was a really close-knit group, and a lot of the players were my dad's friends as well, like Packy, Peter Grant, like, they were his pals as well, do you know what I mean? So it was kind of more than just colleagues, it was more than just, like, teammates, it was, you know, people that you genuinely consider family. So to see everybody kind of collectively experience this little level of joy was so great. And like that, I would only have been about 10, so I don't have like pure mega like vivid memories of it, but I can remember the day. I can remember kind of being in the pitch with Melanie and Lindsay Stark, who was Billy's two daughters. And just so good, and such a good end to the season, because you can then go and like enjoy your holiday and feel like, like as if you've achieved something and fulfilled. And don't get me wrong, it doesn't last long, you need to start all over again, but just for that moment to have achieved that, even like when you see the footage of of the team going back on the bus to Celtic Park, and they go past like the Meyer Bar off Aitkenhead Road and then through the Gallagate and all that, and I could actually burst into tears when I watched that, do you know what I mean? Because they're just so proud, like, and so happy and genuine, and you can just tell everybody's so invested, do you know what I mean? I love watching that so much.
Your dad had a brilliant line in that one. I think we used it, you wouldn't have used now, it's like different times in the sense you need to be a bit more careful, but I don't think it's, but you might not even know the film, you're too young probably, but because they were all running behind the bus and all that, right? Mm-hmm. And your dad said, it's like Zulu Dawn, you know, have you ever seen the film Zulu Dawn?
No, I've heard of it.
I knew exactly what he meant, you know, it's like, kind of, they're all fighting the British and all that kind of stuff, you know, and South Africa and the kind of Boer War and all this kind of thing, you know, and it was like, I think we did use it in The View that week, I think we did, because it was so funny.
Yeah.
I mean, he did. He was capable of some great one-liners.
Very funny. Very funny. And I think the type of person as well that you could get away with saying things that other people couldn't.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's not cheeky, but like it could be quite kind of close to the bone, but the delivery was always so kind of exceptional that you would, I think you would accept it from him in a way that you maybe wouldn't necessarily from other people. But aye, very, very funny, very quick. Didn't miss a beat.
And how many times did you ever hear him singing Mark the Knife?
Oh, I mean,
he was good at it, but
yeah, he was great singer. Do you know what? So he loved Bobby Darin.
Oh yeah.
And it's funny because if I listen to Bobby Darin now, there's certain songs and just certain maybe lines or words where I think, oh my god, that sounds so like my dad, because he's obviously that's who yeah. he's listened to and he's kind of tried to emulate. And yeah, that's like kind of really nostalgic for me. Maybe not even necessarily that song. Do you know what I mean? But other songs more so. And yeah, when I hear them, I'm like, oh god, that really sounds like him. Like he's obviously pure listened to that and tried to sound like him. Do you know what I mean?
Because I used to go through to the Heriot Watt University. They had a mm-hmm. Tommy Burns supper, so yeah, he used yeah. to obviously he would come to all those, you know, and that was how the night would end.
Yeah,
you know, he used to really be really good at that rasp it, you know, the rasp.
Like yeah, totally.
He perfected that.
Definitely,
he really did perfect that.
Because he put a lot of personality in it when he was singing. Do you know what I mean? It's not just like confidence to just absolutely go for it. Do you know what I mean? But that was our kind of life growing up as well. And I'm sure probably most people like my age would maybe say the same about growing up. You know, it was parties in the house and it was one singer, one song. And like they would have written new song nights. So I've just got to come and sing a new song. And you know, don't even dare try and sing along with somebody, just you keep quiet till it's yeah. your turn. One of the ones as well, like if you're bringing somebody to the house and it's like, and if you get a song, what's your song? I mean, the person's terrified at the thought of having to sing in front of a room full of people, but that was just kind of what we done, do you know what I mean?
And that was the same, my mum and dad, it was mm-hmm. slightly different in the sense that we grew up in Lark Hall, so they felt safe
yeah.
in their own company. And the odd mm-hmm. rebel song might slip through, you know, mm-hmm. you couldn't be in mixed company. It was everybody from St Mary's, the McStays and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I know exactly, but my God, they enjoyed themselves. You know, like didn't need clubs, nightclubs or anything. They knew how to party.
Definitely.
It's a big kind of Catholic thing. And that, like, were you made aware or whatever how important his religion was to him from day one?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, 100%, because it was in us as well then from an early age. You went to Mass every Sunday, and, you know, when I think back to that, it was packed. Do you know what I mean? You'd be standing at the back, you couldn't get a seat, and are you always at your same, like, if you went to 12 o'clock Mass on a Sunday, you always had the same kind of bit that your family sat at and somebody else's family sat at. Do you know what I mean? You had your own rows and all that.
I could almost tell you other families where they sat in St Mary's and Lark Hall.
Totally. And then, like, he was a Eucharistic minister at Mass as well, so he would do that. And
it wasn't quite an early, because that was when it was only kind of coming on stream, you know, like they were kind of.
Yeah, so he would have been. And then, like, in my mum and dad's bedroom was a big statue of Our Lady. So you'd have candles around that and rosary beads. So every night we'd go in, kneel around mum and dad's bed, we'd say a decade to the rosary. And it's funny now, let me think back, honestly. So you had to kind of say what your intentions were, what you were praying for. And then sometimes he would quiz you, like, right, so first sorrowful mystery is Jenna. Agony in the garden, look, do you know what I mean? So you had that would roll off your tongue. You'd be terrified that he asked you one that you didn't know. So I would go through the sorrowful mysteries, the joyful mysteries, like all this. He was constantly trying to kind of, not like, it wasn't like forced upon us, because it was all you ever know.
Yeah, and it's there's a kind of joy, like, that's what I thought. I think maybe the reason why I still go or whatever and all that, because it was such a huge part. Mum and Dad, I say, going to Mass every morning, and we had to go to devotions on Sunday, you know. Like, mm-hmm. And I was one of the longest serving altar boys in our parish and all that. Mm-hmm. Falling asleep, like half sleeping, and the thurible goes, you know. Like, it all happened to me. I went on fire one time, backed into a candle, you know, because, you know, you're kind of half awake, you know. Father, he's on fire! And the guy running down to, oh, it was a bit of Frank Spencer things are too old, my references. But that's what I got for your dad as well. wasn't he pious, or it wasn't he kind of judgmental, kind of religious observance. It was, there was some kind of, it's a kind of pure love in a way. It's a pure love.
Do you know, Jonathan, my youngest brother, he sent on a wee clip the other day that I don't know if somebody sent it to him or whatever. It's on YouTube. And I think it's actually a clip from Songs of Praise, and he's at Kilmarnock at the time because he's sitting in the stand with his Kelly gear on. And it's Martin Bashir. You know how the...
Oh, yeah. The old Princess Diana. Yeah, disgraced.
So it was before that.
Of course, I know.
It was him that was interviewing him and basically asking him to choose like a hymn and why this hymn and what his faith means to him and blah, blah, blah. So his hymn was Make Me a Channel of Your Peace, and he was basically saying how like, you know, like as a human being, like you're so frail and it's just somebody that you can put kind of all your trust in and your worries, and it definitely meant so much to him. And now like, I think, God, that was from a really kind of young age to be that. I don't know. I think that's probably quite unusual to be that kind of in tune with your faith. But then obviously, you know, maybe like the pressures of that kind of job and stuff like that. I don't know if that would have kind of sort of forced him into that a wee bit. Do you know what I mean?
It's a bit of a release. Our priest always says, come here. And he said, just for an hour. He said, I'm not saying that you switch off when I'm talking, but just it's almost kind of meditative. It's like the outside world is out there.
Totally.
You're in here.
Definitely. I would say I feel that now more so than ever, I think, because as well, like, you're either on your phone or you're online or you're on WhatsApp or you're, you know, watching the telly, listening to the radio, or if you're out walking, you've got a podcast in, like, you never just be... And I do think that now I feel as if I'm, like, if I'm at Mass now, I'm really conscious of exactly what you've just said, just being there and just having to just be for that period of time. And, it's funny because, I don't get me wrong, like, I've kind of fell away and dipped in and out over the years, I think, just maybe as some people do. But, and not never, like, I wouldn't say I've ever kind of lost my faith, but maybe just didn't necessarily kind of make a point of going to Mass every week. But when I do, I get like a lot from it. Do you know what I mean? Maybe not necessarily to the degree that my dad's was like at all. But
I don't think many of us are in that bracket.
No, I know. But I do. I think, you know, you can certainly get a lot from it, especially for that reason. Just kind of going, switching off, and just kind of immersing yourself in like your own kind of thoughts or intentions. Do you know what I mean?
I know. And for me, that's when I feel closest to my parents, even now, because I knew how much it meant to them.
Same. I'm the exact same. I think that's, just hitting me on the head for me, definitely. I mean, I'll go Mass now and the tears are tripping me probably for the full time that I'm there. I think everybody must think, God, she must be in a really bad way, that girl. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I'm not at all. Like, I'm okay. But for that exact reason, I feel as if that is where I feel, like, closer to them. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I get a lot from it just now, definitely.
Well, like, sometimes our priest throws in, because it's the old congregation, but he throws in some of the old classics, you know, and every time I hear So Love My Saviour, I can hear my mum warble it in 1977, you know, it's St. Mary's Lark Hall.
Totally. Well, I go to St. Mary's in the Calton, and the lady that sings there at 10 o'clock Mass on a Sunday, Teresa Mullen, or Teresa McAnally, but her maiden name is Mullen, but they've always been, the Mullins were always kind of family friends of, like, my dad's side of the family. Like, my gran and Mrs. Mullen were good friends, and the Mullins, I think, were all kind of sang at Mass and stuff like that, and Teresa still sings to this day, and she sang at my dad and my mum's funeral, so I think that's probably even more so. It's actually probably borderline self-harm for me to be going there. She's the most incredible singer ever. She's got the absolute voice of an angel, so I feel as if that as well, it's like a spiritual experience. Like, I recommend anybody to go and listen to Teresa Mullen singing in Mass, because she's just incredible. And like, that it kind of ties you to like your past and people that have been in your life, and God, they sang my grand's funeral and they sang that at my dad's, and do you know what I mean? You've got no distractions there, and you're just sitting kind of immersed in that. It's, you're just allowed to just feel what you feel for that period of time. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely. Definitely. Oh, was it your dad's funeral? And what I always remember is my dad was, he seemed to give up after he got to 80, and I phoned him up and says, "Dad, I'll come out and see you." And he says, "Oh, son, you know, he sometimes just couldn't be bothered. He couldn't be bothered." As my sister always says, his life became about staying alive, you know, those last couple of months. And I could tell he was maybe up the stairs, you know, like in his bed, and doesn't even want to kind of meet the kind of, because if I'm not a visitor, but you're still having to come and have to sit with me or talk to me or whatever, you know, and sometimes you can't be bothered. And I said to him, "Dad, I'm just out at Tommy's funeral and I've got his order of service." He said, "Oh, no, come out, son," you know, because he wanted to see the hymns and all that, you know, because my dad was the choir master at our church. Yeah. So I was like, kind of perked him up, you know, and it sat there for obviously the 4 months my dad was alive, you know, how the order of service, and still got some up here, you know, with funerals have been in the last year or so.
But we were
back at 95 there, actually, like, and then come back to Celtic Park. I used to say to Billy Stark, you know, the most fun you can have without winning a trophy that season again. And I imagine you would begin to remember a bit more, or be a bit more involved. And
oh, definitely, because I think obviously at that point you had, like, you know, like George Cadet and Paul DeCanio and all that. So do you remember those characters as well? And again, like, probably most of my memories of that time is not necessarily of the football. Like, we had one Christmas Day, my dad sprung out on my mum on Christmas Day, that he invited George Cadet and his wife over. So they've landed at our house 7 o'clock, like, aunts and uncles in. Everybody's got a good drink in them, talking nonsense to these two who can hardly speak a word English, do you know what I mean?
Oh, he's a strange fella, George Cadet.
I know.
A horse of a different colour, I would say, you know?
Yeah, there's a wee bit of a kind of revival recently. I feel as if it was all over kind of social media and all that at a point.
I don't know what that was about. I remember his stint in Big Brother and all that, Portuguese Big Brother.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but he was like a kind of 70s rock star.
Aye, definitely, definitely. And then, like, we were on holiday in Cyprus 1 year, we met Pierre, his wife, I think her name was Karina, something like that, met them, and he'd only been a young boy at the time. I think they were through in Ayia Napa and we were in Paphos, and they drove through to see us on holiday. And I remember when we were signing Pierre, I remember going in, my dad was going into the town to drop off videos for him, to watch those videos like Jimmy Johnson and all that. And I think it was the Albany Hotel at the time.
It would have been aye.
So he goes in, me and Emma get left sitting in the car outside for 2 hours while he's in dropping videos off and talking him through all that. And then when it was Paul DeCanna, I remember we just signed him and he was staying in, it was West Point Hotel in East Kilbride. And we were sitting in, like, the restaurant, just kind of waiting for him to come in. I remember he comes in with these, obviously, the hair and all that, and then these, like, the shortest shorts, fluorescent, yellow legs, all waxed, pure tan to the inch's life. It's, like, memories like that are kind of so vivid of that time, but certainly the football as well, and obviously you can go and watch some of the footage now, which is great. I love that, and like, social media is good for that, all the kind of Celtic fan pages and stuff that will maybe do 12 Days of Christmas and stuff like that, and it'll be kind of random things from years and years ago. So it's always great to see that. You're like, oh god, like, what a time, do you know what I mean? Amazing.
Because that was really the rebirth of Celtic and everything. It didn't quite happen for your dad and getting that title, but it needed that kind of step, and it needed him to take it, like, almost within a whisker.
I know.
And it was like, but I did feel sorry for him having to deal with those three guys, because they were impossible to manage. You saw it behind the scenes, you know,
definitely. Like, waves. I mean, I remember even when my dad got the sack, and then the next day, Paul had been in our house, and you'd think he'd get the sack. The way he was, like, do you know what I mean? He's in tears, and he's up, and he's down, his head's in his hands, and, like, doing my dad's comforting him. He's the one that's just been bloody sacked. So yeah, like big characters, but he was such an amazing like kind of people person that he's probably the very, or maybe like one of the only people that at that point could have sort of managed guys like that. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Just because he's such a great kind of way about him, and I think probably the other guys in the team had a lot to do with that, like Peter Grant, Paul McStay, like all these guys. Do you know what I mean? They would have played a massive part in, you know, settling them in and kind of like helping them understand the kind of culture and what they were a part of. Do you know what I mean?
I remember another one of his great lines was, this wasn't to me or anything, but he said it to a journalist privately. And it was like, you think, God, imagine Celtic getting players like this. You know, so these were top-level players, no question about it, top-level players. And Celtic hadn't, they were in the grubber a few years before, so they weren't even as if like people would think, oh, that's where I'll go to further my career or whatever. So it's like, how do you get these players? And he said, well, he said, your dad says, he says, because these players come with baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and sometimes you don't want to open that baggage.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh, it was like, but it was such fun, but it was such, and then the last couple of weeks, as you're saying about, you kind of knew the jig was up after losing that Falkirk semi-final. And I thought your dad knew as well, and it was painful to watch. It was painful to watch.
Yeah, it was so sad. Let's see, when I see now, like pictures of him like coming out the front door and down the side, and oh God, man, I just feel so sad for him when I see it. I do remember that night. I remember him coming home and being in the house, and actually there was a wee boy that lived in our street at the time called Dale, who'd have been maybe ages with Michael. And his grandparents had come to the door that day or the day before, because at that point you're all still playing out in the street and all that, do you know what I mean?
Of course.
And this wee boy's grandparents had come to the door to basically tell us that Dale had been diagnosed with leukemia. And he pulled through and all that, like he was absolutely fine. And then, but I remember that happening at that time, my dad kind of saying, like, what are my problems compared to what that family are facing right now? Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I think as much as he would have been heartbroken, and he was heartbroken,
but
he definitely always had a good perspective, do you know what I mean, in terms of like what is really important and what's kind of temporary or, you know, just kind of relevant to your life as opposed to something that is like tragic or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
I
feel sad for him when I think of that.
Oh yeah, I always admired him, but you know, if you don't know it firsthand, you've probably seen it secondhand or read or whatever. But you know, on that day, because I wasn't supposed to be in that day, and Merrill, my colleague, said, you've got to come in, because I'd stayed up all night to watch the Tories getting battered in the 1997 general election. I stayed up to, like, even Blair was going down the Pall Mall and all that, so I was up to about 1, you know, like about 10 in the morning, and then I thought, I'll get a kit for the rest of the day, and Merrill phoned me, says, you better get in here this afternoon, because it's going to happen, it's brewing, it's going to happen. So we're all kind of there, and you're kind of milling about.
Merrill. I remember Merrill from...
Oh, do you remember Merrill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Merrill. Yeah, with Merrill on, Merrill's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
She loved your dad, you know what I mean? She was a good soul. But your dad, that when they said, oh, you can go out this back way kind of thing and all that, because there's a crowd outside and all that, I said, no, I come in the front door and I'm coming out the front door.
I know, God love him, I know. I hate thinking about that, because it does make me feel so sad for him, do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know, and it was like, we'd seen it, like, I had a terp here. I was a Jonah for that club. Like, cause I remember Billy McNeil's last day and all that, and you think, that kind of, it's big Billy, you know, and kind of, you're brought to your knees in a way by,
I know.
You're kind of, it's no humi-, it's, God, I've lost my job myself not so long ago, but you do feel, I felt personally humiliated, even, you know, it's just.
Yeah, I know, totally, it is. There's probably a fair bit of that, I would say. Do you know what I mean? Just your own kind of pride and as well, like, just knowing how much you've you've put into it, like your whole life, and I mean your whole life, like completely dedicated to that morning, noon and night. And don't get me wrong, like it's, you do, you're kind of lucky and blessed in that you can have a nice lifestyle, but you also sacrifice a lot.
Well, you
for
do.
It. And at that point in time, it wasn't like, you know, guys now that never need to work again because they've played for two seasons or whatever. It was exactly. Far from that, do you know what I mean? So, yeah, like they sacrifice a lot to for the good of like the team and the club and wanting to do better and constantly kind of striving to improve and stuff like that. And yeah, to kind of not then, you know, to not kind of achieve what you want to as so sad, I think.
And I loved, of course, I loved Celtic winning the title the next season, but there was a wee pang for me, you know, because by then it wasn't your dad. Paul wasn't the captain. Paul did, and I kind of grew up, we grew up the next day, so like we were like, you know, it was very close and our parents were very close and all that kind of stuff. And even Peter wasn't there. All these guys, and you think, how can it not happen when they were, you know?
Oh,
and it's like, I don't resent anybody, and it was like, thank God it happened and all that. But, you know, I couldn't help but it's like,
if I'm being totally honest, I probably did at points, do you know what I mean?
I can understand that.
Do you know what I mean? Because you think, oh, God, like, I wonder if he did one more season, like, would they? And a lot of the players that brought in were players that were already being scouted and stuff like that, do you know what I mean? So you kind of think, oh, if you just, but also understand the reasons why. Do you know what I mean? As like a football fan, do you know what I mean? Like I completely understand the reasons, but from like a personal and quite selfish point of view, you just want to see, and you know how much that person wanted it and how much they put into it, and you think, God, nobody deserves it more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to not get it, it's just sad.
Yeah. And did you go to then, like, when your dad was down at Reading and that, did you all go down there?
Yeah, so we were at Newcastle first.
Oh, yeah, sorry, aye.
We never moved to Newcastle. He stayed down there. It was only a couple hours down, so he actually...
So he actually got
the train up and down. And then when we went to Reading, Emma never came because she was going through her exams at that point in time, so she stayed with my aunt and uncle. They just lived next to Holyrood Secondary, so she stayed there. And then it was me, my mum, my dad, Michael and Jonathan, that went down to Reading, so, and just so different, like, from, I mean, we were used to, like, going and sitting at my grand's all day on a Saturday, like, morning and night, with everybody in and out, and do you know what I mean? It was just completely different. And then, like, don't get me wrong, like, the Bonners moved down at the same time as well, so we were always really so close with them anyway, like, always lived close by still to this day, like, are really kind of close with them and stuff, so it was good to have them there. And then my dad signed Peter, I think he signed about 18 Scottish players, I think, when he went down, but he eventually signed Peter Grant as well, so he actually lived with us for a wee while, and it
he's
was quite funny
director.
Because...
He's been on here. Yeah.
Boy. Aye, I'm surprised I'm still on the amount he can talk. He's brilliant. But I always remember when he stayed with us, my mum would like pure go to like extra effort for dinners and it was sweets and all that. And my dad always like, oh God, if standards are slipping, just call the granny. Do you know what I mean? They'll soon be turning up for the when he appears. And I think actually Peter was out with my mum the day that my dad got the sack for Reading. And they were standing in the queue in the bank or something like that. And I don't know if he phoned Peter or mum, but anyway, one of the two of them. And I remember Peter saying, mum was like, oh yeah, beauty, we'll need to get something nice for the dinner the night. Because she was just that excited that we were all going to be moving back up the road. So yeah, it was Reading took a while to settle in. And like at the time, like my gran on my mum's side passed away and stuff like that. And we were down there. So it was quite difficult, and obviously Emma not being there and things like that. So it wasn't like the best time, and obviously being that age, had to been, I don't know, maybe about 14 or 15, something like that.
So
and kind of going down and having to adjust to like a new school at that age, and nobody can understand what you're saying. You would think you were talking Chinese, do you know what I mean? Because they did not understand a word I said. And then
still wouldn't they, by the way, they still wouldn't they?
I know.
I don't mean you particularly.
Andrew Bourne and I were in the same class, and he'd be translating for me. And I'm thinking, how do they understand what you're saying and not me? made good friends and all that were there. Like, eventually, kind of settled in. Stevie Keane, he was at Reading at the time. I think he played in like Celtic Youth. So he'd been a good few years younger than my dad, but we got like quite close with him and his wife Margaret at the time. So they were good to kind of have down there and stuff like that. So it wasn't like the worst time for me anyway. My mum absolutely hated it. But Michael hated it as well. He was terrible. I think he was ever out of his teacher's office crying and all that in school. It was an experience. You know something? We were so lucky probably in the time that my dad done the job that he'd done that we never had to move away. That was the first and only time. So, you know, there's families that have been moving every kind of couple of years and stuff like that. So we never, ever had to do that. So we were really fortunate in that sense. That was us. And then we were back up. And then I think Kenny took him back into Celtic at that point.
That's right.
And that was us then. That was us back there for good.
And then Scotland as well, working with.
So I think it was Betty Votes at first and then Walter and Ali, which was obviously good. And like, I think there was probably more in made of that than, because it was like, oh god, like he's for Celtic and they're for Rangers. And like, even when my dad died, it would have been a big thing that they'd kind of carry his coffin and stuff like that. And there was no kind of, there was no show there. They just kind of were what they were. Like, do you know what I mean? They got on really well and probably never knew each other that well prior to that, but became like really, really good friends. And I think just constant laughs and carry on. And I know it really, he thoroughly enjoyed that. He loved that.
Yeah, and Walter used to talk about his timekeeping. He didn't expect, you know, he thought, you know, because he'd be a bit... You're speaking to Mr. Disorganised, so I'm not dissing your dad.
I'm not time for it, and I'm terrible.
He was saying he just couldn't believe that he was so disorganised and all that. And God, I mean, your dad's, it's Friday press conference, and sometimes it was supposed to, you know, start at 12:30. You'd be waiting at 3:10, and he wouldn't have shown.
I know. But don't you think it's weird, though? You'd never think, how rude. Like, you would never have that thought, because he would come in and he would make a joke or whatever, and you'd be like, oh, okay, like, do you know what I mean? Yeah, he just had that way about him. He would get away with stuff like that, and he'd be sitting talking to somebody. I'm a bit like that myself. Like, if I was talking to you, in fact, it was the same when I was on the phone to you the other night. You had somewhere to be, and so did Dad, but we ran over by about 10 or 15 minutes because, like, I'm the exact same way myself. Do you know what I mean? I can't kind of say no. Like, I need to have the conversation and then just deal with the consequences later if I'm running late for something.
I have the same, and my brother's the same. It's like, you know, he's got friends, they always say to him, you know, John, time's no elastic. Don't know who. Somebody should have told you that a long, long time ago. Yeah. But it's just, you always think, you know, like, my pals always say to me, build in a margin for error. It's like, you know, trying to get the games at 2:50. Sometimes it's like, what? Have they made it to 3:30? And it's like, but you were only trying to get there 2 minutes before 3:00. You've not built in any margin for error.
My mum used to always say that to me. She's like, Jen, if you need to be somewhere and it takes 10 minutes, you leave with 10 minutes to go.
That'll
to be there. Instead of thinking, right, okay, I'll maybe leave about 20 minutes just in case. Like, I'm like, no, if I can get there in 7 minutes, so I'll leave with seven minutes to go, do you know what I mean? And never learn the lesson.
But it was so great that, you know, he found his way back to Celtic. It felt kind of how it should be.
Yeah. Definitely, and I think he enjoyed his time, and obviously it was like a massive kind of learning curve for him then when he went back, like taking on the kind of youth setup and stuff like that. That was like really out of his comfort zone. Not like the coaching side and all that. That's exactly where he wanted to be and what he wanted to be doing, but all the kind of administrative stuff that came with that, because that was before Lennox Town. That was, you know, trying to get all that kind of off the ground and training facilities and travelling to different clubs in different countries to see what they'd done. And so it was a lot. I would say he was really, really pushed out his comfort zone at that point in time.
Do you think he enjoyed it?
Oh, I definitely. He definitely did. Again, probably more so the kind of training side of it as opposed to all the administrative stuff that they've been involved as well. But yeah, loved it. I think loved all the boys that you kind of worked with over the years, and you know, we came back in, they would talk to us about like, well, Aidan McGeady went to our school, he's a few years younger than me, but we'd talk about like Aidan McGeady or Simon Verry or whoever was the
Darmody. Darm speaks Darmody, so highly of.
Yeah. Loved, adored him.
Mutual.
Yeah, and it's funny because, I mean, I think, I don't know which one it was, but I remember Jonathan kind of saying at one point, like, I think he loved them more than he loved, do you know what I mean? Because he just, I think he did good. A lot of the guys as well obviously moved away from their homes at a young age, so they'd be staying in digs, and so I think he was really involved in all that and kind of knew that, like, sometimes he would know the families that they stayed with and things like that, so really wanted to kind of take care of them, and I think probably like put their parents' minds at ease as well, as to, you know, they're being looked after and cared for, do you know what I mean? Not just here to kind of like do their job almost, do you know what I mean? Because they were so young, a lot of the guys.
Yeah. And when did, obviously, he thought, I mean, I don't know when it was first his first diagnosis, but kind of thought had been caught and kind of, he was in remission, wasn't he?
So I think it was 2006, I want to say. And it had
used to start seeing him wearing the cap.
Yeah.
You know, like,
totally. That would have been just after he was kind of diagnosed initially. So he had a mole on his, I think it was like his left leg, like in his thigh. And just for as long as I can remember, do you know what I mean? And it was one of the doctors in Celtic Park, I think, would it have been Roddy?
Oh, would it be Roddy McDonald at that time?
Yeah, I think
it would have been.
Yeah, and I think he just clocked it one day and said to him, have you ever did that, like, checked? And he was like, not. And, like, he wasn't a sun worshipper, but he did shorts on every day.
Part of the job, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So then he went and obviously took like a biopsy and stuff like that, and I remember him telling us it was like malignant melanoma, and at that point just having no clue whatsoever, and actually thinking, all right, well, skin cancer, that's fine, like, do you know what I mean? If you're going,
yeah,
to get cancer,
get it kind of really cut out or burnt off or something.
Yeah, totally. So naive. And at that point, like, years and years, when I was, like, 18 and stuff, I'd been using sunbeds and things like that, do you know what I mean? And I remember, like, my dad kind of saying to me, like, that's dangerous and blah, blah, blah. Obviously, never been on one in my life since, but just no clue whatsoever. Yeah, so at that point, obviously, kind of gave him the biopsy, malignant melanoma, had to go in then and spend quite a period of time in the Royal because they had to kind of, like, cut in more and take more out his leg, and there was talk of like skin grafts and all that at one point. And I remember him being like really kind of, he was quite a sort of reflective, quite a philosophical person anyway, like a good person to have like a real life chat with, like really profound conversation, do you know what I mean? And I remember like him being quite, especially like that when he was in the hospital at that point in time. So obviously you're just get so much thinking time and stuff like that. But anyway, eventually, you know, had to go through some treatment and stuff like that. And then it was like a preventative treatment as opposed to like something that was going to cure it, if that makes sense. Because there wasn't really
was it kind of radiotherapy at that time or something?
Yeah, something like that. And it was like other kind of like trial drugs and things like that. And the whole point was to prevent it from kind of coming back or whatever, which was fine because it hadn't sort of spread anyway at that point or anything like that. So he was then like in remission and he was fine, like totally fine. And then it would have been then, I think maybe the November of the following year, so 2007. And I didn't know this at the time, but I found out when he was then kind of diagnosed again in the February, but he was experiencing a lot of pain, like in his stomach and things like that. Like he'd be up in the night kind of, you know, sitting on the edge of the bed, kind of like cradling his tummy because he was in like excruciating pain. And he went to the doctors at that point, the doctor or consultant who he'd seen prior, and she had said to him that it was just anxiety and not to kind of worry about it. It had never done anything at that point. And then...
Oh, dear.
I know, it would have been the February then after, because it was when Emma's Cole was born. Cole's going to be 17 next month. So, and it was the day Cole was born that he was going back. Because I remember waking up, he was born at maybe like 2:15 in the morning or something like that. And I remember getting up to go to my work. And my mum saying, oh, you'll need to ask your work if you can get away and go up and see like Emma and the baby at lunchtime. I was just assuming I would go up that night and they two would obviously go during the day. And I was like, how are you and my dad not going? Because my dad would be like, Emma's in the house, talking into her belly and all that. I'm just desperate to be a granda, like, just so looking forward to it. And then, so I went to my work, got away, went up to see him in the baby, and she's like, weird, where's mum and dad? And I was like, well, I don't know, dad's got an appointment or something. Like, it was just strange, do you know what I mean? And then I got home from my work, and my mum told me then that her and my dad had been back to the hospital. My dad had kind of been for more tests, blah, blah, blah. And that they basically said at that point he was like, he had cancer in his liver, his stomach, and it was terminal. And there was like nothing they could do. And I remember her telling me, and I remember literally being like, think back now, it was almost like in a panic attack. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember it was like somebody had winded me, like I couldn't breathe when she was talking to me. And then we were all then going up that night to see Emma in the hospital. So, like, me, mom, my dad, Michael and Jonathan. And I remember like, when we went in and my dad being, like, so upset like, when he seen Emma and the baby. So not in the way that you would be just emotional.
Yes,
like,
of course. You know what I mean? Just thinking that you'll only be around to see this child
exactly
grow.
That. And then, so she had Cole and Wishaw General, and then we went... In fact, we came back out to car. The car wouldn't start. So this is typical of our life, right? Like that was kind of just kind of almost like a bit of comedy value. Do you know what I mean? So out, car wouldn't start. At one point, Michael is out trying to push the car, but my dad's keeping his foot on the brake. And meanwhile, Michael's feet are trying to push this car. This is all out in the car park. And we went for something to eat. And I remember he ordered a steak and he ordered it rare. And my dad never ate steak rare ever. And I know people would like be disgusted, but he would always have it like well done, like absolutely well done, no blood, no nothing.
Well, you're talking to a vegan, so I would rather have a steak like that than see the blood.
Okay. You'd be definitely offended then. So, but yeah, he would never have ate it like that. Like that would have turned him off. He'd have sent that back. Do you know what I mean? Because that would have turned his stomach. And I remember thinking, that's so weird. Like, why is he doing that? And then kind of afterwards like found out it was all to do with like red blood cells and stuff like that. And I remember then he'd done like kind of so much research into kind of natural remedies, and because obviously there was nothing medically that they could do. So he was like researching it as a woman and she lives in Colorado and she'd done this and I've tried to email her and obviously using the internet at that point in time, which was completely different from the internet now, do you know what I mean? And then he got the opportunity to go to Paris, because there was like a world-renowned doctor there who was doing this like trial treatment and things like that, and you know this could be like, and at this point you're thinking you're going to get a miracle because there is literally no alternative. Do you know what I mean? Because you can't imagine anything but that happening. So him and my mum and Gregory Dupont, who was the sports scientist at the time, he was French, so he went with them so that he could translate for them. So they went to Paris and he basically came back like within 2 weeks. The doctor that was there had said to my mum, he's like, I've never seen somebody decline so rapidly in my entire life. Basically. So when he left, you know, like in the week leading up to him going away, he was still going to his work and all that. Do you know what I mean? Looking back in pictures now, I'm like, oh God, how did I not see how unwell he was? I can see it so clearly now, but I couldn't then. And then when he came back and he was like his face was drawn in, he'd shaved his head because he was so warm and sweating all the time. And so, I mean, he'd aged a bit. He looked a bit 80 when he came back. It was so shocking to see him within the space of 2 weeks. And that was the Friday night. And he went into the beats and on the Friday night, got home on the Saturday, and basically that was him home then, just to kind of be made comfortable and whatever. So we got a hospital bed in.
Palliative care.
So that was them in the house. So that was then. So what would that have been? The Wednesday morning then, the earlier was that he passed away, or the earlier was the Thursday, can't remember, one of the two. Yeah, and that was it really. So it was short. It was like, so from Cole being born to the day my dad passed away, that was 12 weeks exactly. So what, like, it was really short, as I say, like, from my point of view, you're just thinking, you know, he's going to be fine. But even when he was home in the house, in the hospital bed, you're genuinely thinking, no, like, if there's anybody going to get a miracle in this world, it's him, because he deserves it so much. Like, there is no alternative here. Like, we can't lose him. Do you know what I mean?
And how is it when this is all kind of playing out in public, as it were, in the sense of...
Do you know what? I honestly don't think you're that aware of that, because you're so, like consumed by your own grief and the grief of your family, that you're actually not, like, afterwards. I remember, like, one of my friends kind of giving me, she's like, I've taped, like Super Scoreboard, like, off the radio for you to listen to, because it was so lovely, like, the show, like, and people maybe kind of saying, oh, like, I kept these papers for you, I knew you wouldn't have seen them at the time, but I thought you'd maybe want to look at them after, because it was so nice, like, but at the time, definitely not tuned into that at all. What I would say is, like, I never had to, like, phone my work. I never had to sort of phone my friends and say, oh, this has happened, because everybody knew within the space of a few hours, do you know what I mean? And then I do remember, like, the day of the funeral, though, like, the house was packed, like, morning, noon and night. Like, you were waking up in the morning and the house was full. You were going to bed, the house was full. I remember, like, we had, like, the rosary and all that in the house, like, the night before his funeral, and like, his coffin was in the living room. There was, like, patio doors in the living room out to the back garden. So the house was packed right through the kitchen, up the hall, back garden, all the people there, like, saying the rosary. And actually, I was saying to you earlier on about the Mullins trees. A Mullin was in the house that night, yeah. Sang a couple of hymns, just beautiful. So that was, like, quite a surreal experience. I remember then on the morning of the funeral coming out in the cars to the bottom of the street, and there was actually, like, loads of people that were in our parish, like St. Caddox, just standing at the bottom of the street, just waiting for us to pass, sort of thing. And then at the end of the road, so we lived in Newton Mearn, so just as you go onto the motorway, so where it is, like, Waitrose and stuff like that now, that was all a building site at that point in time, and there was, like, all the workies all standing, like, a row, maybe about 15 of them, something like that, and all standing with their, like, holding their, like, their kind of helmets to their chests as we passed them, and it's just unbelievable. Like, I almost wish now that, you know, somebody had, like, kind of filmed that journey for all the things that we've seen on the way, people just stopping, getting out their cars and all that. It was unbelievable.
Just a sign of the kind of respect that he commanded.
Really? Yeah, it really was.
And still does, and in some ways, even his kind of legend has grown in the 15 years, you know, like, because, again, I'm going to be honest here, you'll have seen the other side of it, like, I mean, he's a kind of, he's beloved by the Celtic sport now and all that, but it's some tough times, you know, like, when you're a manager and you're not successful, and tough times as a player, even, people didn't always appreciate his talents, for me, because, obviously, I was an acolyte, so, like, gosh, too slow. Priest used to say, I slows the game down all the time. You know, my mom used to argue, no, he doesn't. Just did these arguments in the sacristy, you know, with the priest, because he wasn't a Tommy Burns fan, and she was, you know. Like, you can almost hear it, you know, after Mass, and it was the voice is raised.
That's funny.
But, and then you know, like, it's such a legacy, like, and you're part of that legacy, that he's such a kind of, I mean, again, like, it's not everybody, both their parents, when they die, and I know it was terrible circumstance for your mum, but it's in the newspapers, that must be a kind of, it's great to feel kind of part of something bigger, but, you know, like, we all want to kind of...
No, I know, it's funny, like, see, when you don't know any different, you can't really compare anything, do you know what I mean? Excuse me, I was surprised. Obviously, my mum, I think, because of the circumstances, like when she took not well on the flight and stuff, so I've got no idea how people actually kind of found out about that. Like, for me, I was supposed to be going to pick her up for Glasgow Airport, and then I'd been in Tenerife with her and came home, because I was only there for a few days. I was just hijacking the holiday because they were the ones who are going, I'm coming.
As you do, you know, if you can.
It's a going holiday without me tagging on. And they were meant to be there for a fortnight, and then I'd go home, and she had maybe not been that well like the day before we left, but in the past couple of years, her health wasn't great. Now, don't get me wrong, this was never something that was on the cards, like, at all in the past few years, but for her to maybe, like, be not well a day and kind of take to her bed, it wasn't that unusual, do you know what I mean? Because she would rally the next day and she would be fine. Like, it was just, she was just a wee bit up and down like that. So when I left, she maybe wasn't that well. And then the following day when I got home, I was on the phone to Emma, and she's like, I think Mum's going to need to come home. And I was like, right, what could possibly happen in the space of 24 hours? Like, yous have been so dramatic, all that. And she's like, no, like, she's really, like, she's just not well. I think she might come home. And I was like, right, we'll tell her. I'll come back out and I'll fly back with her. And she was like, no, don't, like, don't need to do that at all. She actually had friends, Denise and Alan, who were friends of my dad as well. Who, funnily enough, were with us in Tenerife. My dad got the Celtic job. They were still there. They were in Tenerife this time as well. And they were coming home on the Tuesday. So my mum was just going to fly home with them. And I was like, well, that's fine. Tell her I'll come pick her up for the airport. She was due in maybe, like, I don't know, back at 2 a.m. or something like that. And I thought, I'll go back and stay with her. And if she's not well, like really not well, I can take her A&E or whatever if she needs to, but not thinking in a million years that's what would happen. And then, then the next thing, Emma phoned. So I'm on the phone to Emma in the middle of the night because she's like, I've woke up, I've tracked Mum's flight, it's been diverted to Cork. And I was like, surely not. Please God tell me that this is not because she's taken up well in this flight. And anyway, so then sure as fate, Denise phoned Emma to say, like, your mum's not well, but it's fine. We're in an ambulance, we're going to the hospital. Like, she's sitting up, she's okay, but she just took a turn on the plane. So I'm like, right, okay, fine. So at this point then, I'm like, right, how do I get to Cork? Not an easy place to get to, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
So I then had to book a flight to Dublin. So Emma's in Tenerife. Jonathan's in Boston because he lives there. Michael's down in London for his birthday. Now, we're not that type of family. We're always within quite close proximity, bar Jonathan, obviously, because he lives in America. So it was so unusual for that to be the situation where we're all kind of not anywhere near each other. So I had then booked a flight to go to Dublin and hired a car from Dublin to drive to Cork. And when I was in Edinburgh, so to go through Edinburgh, I was in Edinburgh Airport waiting for my flight, and I phoned the hospital just to speak to the doctor, just to see what was the kind of latest. And she made it clear, like, your mum's, she's like, she's not going to survive this. If you can get here, sort of thing. And I was like, well, I'm on my way, but I will be a few hours, because obviously I'm nowhere near. And then when the plane actually touched down in Dublin, and I switched my phone on, so the plane was still moving, and Emma was phoning me, and I was like, I know what she's going to say here, because she knew I was on the flight, so she wouldn't have been phoning me. So she did, she phoned me, and obviously was like, wish didn't you tell me, like, I knew. And then by the time I got to the car hire place, there was people texting me and phoning me to say, God, so sorry, heard about your mum. Like, and I'm like,
how does that happen?
I have no idea. Genuinely no idea, because it's not even as though it was like a hospital in Glasgow and somebody would have maybe an owner, or do you know what I mean? Not like that at all.
How did so that feel?
Sorry, what were you going to say?
How did that feel then? Like, you know, and did it feel like intrusion in that kind of sense? And how does people know?
No, I don't think I thought of it that way, to be honest. And again, a wee bit of, like, God forgive me for saying it, but you then don't necessarily need to phone, obviously, the people that needed to know, like, in our kind of
close. Yeah, I never thought about that, because that's what I just couldn't do it with anybody. You just try to tell my wife to tell one friend and then leave.
100%, totally. So, yeah, no, I wouldn't say I thought of it in that way, and obviously, like, it's nothing but kind words that you get from people, do you know what I mean? So it's like it's lovely and people are so kind in situations like that, and sometimes people just don't know what to say. And even now, like, you know, I've got friends that maybe lost their parents or whatever, and you don't know what to say. Like,
I'm terrible.
Because you know that there is not a single thing that I can say to you right now that's going to make you feel any better. I've had a few funerals
and I think I should be better than that. I should be better than that, but I just don't want to say something trite.
I know. There's nothing that you can, do you know what I mean? Like, and I think, like, that I work with a girl and she lost her mum at the start of last year. So we're an absolute joy to be around, as I'm sure you can imagine, day to day in work.
Lucky I don't work beside you.
I know. But we talk about stuff like that quite a lot, and sometimes too, as we sit in the tears or tripping as well, while we're sitting working, do you know what I mean? And just like how, you know, today might feel like the absolute worst day in the world, but see, tomorrow you actually might wake up and you'll feel okay. And don't get me wrong, sometimes you can then be in a kind of false sense of illusion, like, God, right, actually I feel as if I've turned a corner here, like I feel okay. And then something and nothing can happen and you feel as if you've been punched in the stomach and you're back to square one, do you know what I mean? So there's no, like, you couldn't even tell somebody almost like what to expect, or, you know, you'll start to feel better, this will happen, that will happen. Like, you literally can only take each day as it comes and just hope that tomorrow's better. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. And do you, like, in the sense of the kind of special place, I mean, does that give you a lot of comfort? Like, as you say, people kind of care about the Burns family, you know, because you become a kind of one of those kind of special Celtic families, and the way that they revere your dad and the way they remember your dad, it's these are positive vibes, good vibes, you know. You must get a lot of good vibes for people.
100%, totally. And people are so kind, and, like, you know, sometimes people maybe like randomly approach you in different kind of settings, whether it's, I don't know, normally if you're in a pure Celtic pub, but do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying it was pure day-to-day, like, at all. And people are always like, oh, so I don't want to bother you, like, I don't want, do you know what I mean? And I'm like, I would talk to you all day. Like, do you know what I mean? There's nothing better than hearing, like, a story you've never heard before, or, you know, maybe, like, that even you telling me about, like, your mum and, like, her kind of arguing with the priest and stuff like that, do you know what I mean? Like, I love stuff like that. Like, it's so nice to hear stories that you've never heard before, or ones that you've heard a million times. Do you know what I mean? It's great. Like, it's cute. I could talk about the same things all day, every day. Do you know what I mean? If it's about, like, my dad or my mum, like,
you know, that there was one that I told somebody that, you know, I work sometimes I work with the Catholic newspaper Flourish, and that, and the fella that works for that, I don't know, we were at a interfaith dialogue thing the other day. I think I said to you, I was saying that I was going to be having you on the podcast, and that he said, oh, I always remember a great story. He said, Tommy had come into a school, and he was talking about his faith. He was talking about, and he was saying to the guys, it's really important you go to Mass every Sunday. Mm-hmm. He said, this week the guy piped up and said, Tommy, he says, but my dad says you don't need to go to Mass. And Tommy said to him, son, I've got something to tell your dad when you get back. He says, what's that, Tommy? He says, tell him I'm right and he's wrong. You know, it's like, he's one of those guys, it's amazing, everybody will have different stories, I'm sure. Like, I don't mean to be saying this to you, you know better than me, but he feels like one of those guys that, see, when people tell you stories about him, they're so, he's almost, you can conjure him up.
Yeah.
You know, even just in a simple story.
Yeah, totally.
There's certain people like that, they just get that kind of, does that make any sense? I don't know if I'm making any sense there.
No, I totally get it. And I feel, I don't know if that's why people kind of are warm to him so much, because I think you instantly feel as if you knew him. Do you know what I mean?
That's
like, I think, like, you feel, like, through conversation, you felt as if you had a personal, like, kind of connection with him. Like, I could see it myself, do you know what I mean? Because I would be with him and he would meet people or they would talk to him, and it wasn't like somebody he'd never seen or never spoke to before in his life. He never spoke to anybody like that. Do you know what I mean? He spoke to everyone. Do you know what I mean?
It's almost you were with him rather than there was a certain kind of, he took you within his kind of company, if you like, or whatever, you know. I can see that. Mm-hmm. I can see that. And for you, like, I mean, you talk about YouTube and social media. I mean, do you kind of, like, because just you could find so much out there with your dad and up. I mean, I know I would if I that kind of, I wish I had some of that kind of stuff about my mum, and I can't even find those pictures are in.
Well, do you know something? Let's see, for that, I actually think, especially at that time, because it wasn't, let's see, my mum, for example, like Cole and Eve and Ethan, my nephews and my niece, they have got all these like Snapchat videos where they're like winding it up and noising it up in the car when she's driving, and it's so funny like to watch some of them because it's so like just natural, and she wouldn't have known that they were filming her and stuff like that. So it's great to watch that. And obviously we never probably had that so much with like my dad, because everything that you would have had would have been, you know, an interview or like stuff like that. But it's so good to have that as well, because you can just, there's so many different, even now, like I said to you, that thing that Jonathan sent, the Songs of Praise.
I've never seen it before.
Do you know what I mean? So even to hear them speaking about something, and like, it's funny, there's the, he had like a kind of testimonial night, and when would that have been? That might have been like 2006 maybe, and it was a night in one of the big hotels in the town, and he sang Mac the Knife. He done like a speech, I think it was Tony Hamilton that was kind of hosting the night, and I think he had to cut about three speakers out the night because my dad had ran on, so probably what I'm doing now with you. And he, it's funny because like for me watching that now, I'm like, I can actually tell when he's going to say something he thinks is funny, because I can see the night over, do you know what I mean? And stuff like that is amazing, I do think, and like that, even like the footage of him like singing and stuff like that, like, nobody, and even times that I'll see when he was a young man that, you know, I might not even have been born, but to see that is so amazing. And I do feel like so, so lucky to have that. And I would, like, sometimes you go down a rabbit hole, just literally put his name in something, but by the same token, and not to take it in a negative turn, but with like Twitter, like I had that before, and you would put something, and sometimes you'd see the most vile, horrendous, you know, thing. We guys don't even know what we're talking about, do you know what I mean? But just saying it to be, I don't know, cool or funny or,
yeah.
I don't know, like to shock or whatever. And for me, I would say, as much as it's a lot of rubbish, it's kind of not worth being on it. Like, to when you see that kind of thing, do you know what I mean? You almost think, oh, I'd rather not even be in those, the orbit of those people, do you know what I mean?
Definitely.
But like I said, like, obviously on the likes of Instagram, it's all just photographs and, so there will be like the kind of old Celtic pages that you'll follow, and you'll always see stuff that will come up that you've never seen before, and it's amazing. Or ones that you see all the time that you're still like, oh, I love that, that's brilliant. Like, it's great to see.
And do you still feel that? Is there a bond with Celtic? You talked about Tony. I was Tony's best man, actually. But like, we don't see each other that much now. He's been on here. He's been on the podcast as well. But Tony's just a workaholic now, you know. Yes. Like, oh my goodness!
I texted him
last week. Oh, I'm just in New York kind of thing and all that. With the charity foundation and all that, you know. He really puts his heart and soul into it.
Oh, definitely.
But I love Tony. Tony got on well with, got on really well with Tommy, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think when we first went back to Celtic, Tony was doing the stuff on like the mic at half time and all
that.
So I feel as if in the time that I've known him, he's worn so many different hats within. No.
Got a minute, Celtic. He doesn't like to me say it, but I got a minute. He was a DJ, and he was doing the DJing at half time at Hampden, and I said, you can do a wee quiz in the programme and all that, and before you know it, I said, you can write a wee bit and all that. And then he was doing the club call and all this, because he's, you know what I mean, he's got the patter and everything.
Aye, definitely. He's never looked back, really.
No, dissimilar to your dad in some kind of ways, you know, that kind of...
Yeah, quite a dry sense of, very dry sense.
Very kind of, you know, I am what I am and you take me as I am.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, before, like, we have people kind of phoning the Samaritans on us, like, we better, like...
I know, definitely.
But... What an absolute pleasure, genuine absolute pleasure. I'm sorry, I, you know, you need to be sensitive, and I hope I haven't upset you, you know what I mean?
No, not at all. You caught me on a good day. On another day, it could have been sending some Samaritans to my door. No, but I appreciate it. It was nice. It was really nice to chat with you, and thanks so much for
asking. No, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, you're in my prayers now.
Thank you. so much. I appreciate it.
Sure, your dad will appreciate that.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. We hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. Please share the joy of Celtic Underground, rate us wherever you can find us on your podcast provision, and also subscribe to the CelticUnderground.substack.com. As you'll be aware, there are two types of subscription. There's free subscription, where you get a certain amount of content delivered directly to your email address, and then there's a paid-for subscription, where you get even more content delivered directly to your email address as and when it comes out. Anyway, enough of me. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.